I'll give you the benefit of the doubt. Until I see for myself, that is. Hand me back to Romero.
Mabbott must have betrayed a moment's confusion.
Romero, Melville repeated. The man who wants to kill you.
Chapter 5. It was 2 in the afternoon when he awoke. The inside of the tent was womb-like and powerfully hot. He looked twice at his travel clock, then lay back staring for a while at the peak of the tent. The first thing that struck him was that there was a peak at all, making the tent feel more like a teepee. And no polyester or aluminium ribbing here. This was a proper canvas tent, awakening childhood memories of campsites and fruit gums. It had been almost light when he finally got to sleep, after Melville's men had come to the village and extracted him. Nirvan and Farood, who had been taken into the forest, had already left. So terrified had they been that as soon as they were freed, they'd headed hell for leather back to their homes and wives and children, leaving Mabbott no option but to go wherever he was taken. The two very dark-skinned, wide-eyed boys Melville had sent to collect him had smiled a lot but spoke no English, so Mabbott could glean no information about where they were or where he was being taken. They had arrived with a flourish an hour or so after Melville's call, their battered jeep racing into the village ahead of a cloud of rising dust. They looked as though they were enjoying what they were doing and were received with envious admiration by the younger villagers. The older men and women had remained aloof, clearly still intimidated by the insurgents in their midst. Mabbott pulled aside the tent flap and looked around him. He was in a circular encampment outside a small village of mud and wattle huts. Majestic trees stood in isolation among wispy brown grassland, giving the impression of some great estate gone to seed. Mabbott could see no one else around, but then his eye was caught by movement in the village and the sound of a voice. He looked again and saw a young child leaning out from the corner of a hut, staring towards him. He waved. The child disappeared. Mabbott felt an urgent need to relieve himself. There was a stout tree nearby, so he walked over and stood behind it, making sure he was hidden from the village. As his pee hissed copiously onto the dry grass, he luxuriated in the pleasant sense of relief on all fronts. Then he heard a noise, and peering warily out from behind the trunk, he found three small boys standing in a line, watching him curiously. The tallest of the three seemed to be the spokesman.
"Toilet," he said,
leading Mabbott to one of the farthest tents. He solemnly pulled aside the flap to reveal a privy, towel rail, and canvas basin with water beside it.
"Shukriya."
"Thank you," said Mabbott,
hoping that a wide, self-deprecating smile would encourage them to laugh at his foolishness. If anything, it merely added a hint of pity to their serious, uncomprehending gaze. On an impulse, he returned to his tent, rummaged around in his things, and retrieved a quarter-pound bag of glacier mints. He took out three and turned back to the children, only to find that another three had joined them. He went back to the bag and took out more sweets, by which time 6 more expectant faces had gathered. This time, he brought out the bag. There were just enough to go round. The smaller boys clutched the tiny white polar bears warily until the ringleader popped one in his mouth. Soon there were more than a dozen little jaws at work. In the distance, Mabbott could see a row of veiled heads peering curiously over the scrub and stick fence at the edge of the village. There were shouts, and the children turned and ran home. Mabbott gratefully took the last mint in the bag, aware that he was not only hungry, but hot. Seeking the shade of the tent, he took out his notebook and pen. The last 24 hours had been so extraordinary, he scarcely knew where to begin. In fact, he couldn't begin. Writing things down had been his life, but at this moment, words felt superfluous. He was in the grip of events. He sat cross-legged on his low bed, and, a little nervously at first, he listened to the silence around him. After what seemed a very long time, he heard whispers, and a small hand reached in and cautiously pulled aside his tent flap. It was the same boy who'd spoken to him earlier.
"Food,"
he said, beckoning Mabbott outside. The boy had not come alone, and a much emboldened little group greeted Mabbott's emergence from the tent with a puckering of lips and raising of fingers to mouths. Their ringleader pushed them aside, and taking Mabbutt by the hand, led him towards the village. Mabbutt wasn't sure what he'd been given to eat. It was some kind of corn mash, sticky and substantial, but not particularly tasty. It was served with rice and chilies, in a bowl made from a large leaf that had been folded and pierced at either end with sharpened sticks. He ate in the cool semi-darkness of a room in one of the huts. In shape and size, the room was almost identical to the one in which he'd been interrogated the night before. Two young women and an older man sat with him, while some of the bigger children watched from the doorway, silhouetted against the sunlight. They were not short of entertainment, as Mabbutt struggled both with the lotus position and with the unfamiliar technique of eating with his fingers. The older man, it seemed, couldn't bear to watch such incompetence, and bending low, he disappeared into the recesses of the house. The women, elaborately ornamented, gazed impassively at Mabbutt. As his eyes adjusted to the gloom, he could see that the doorways on both sides were bordered with ornate patterns in what looked like pen and wash. After a while, the older man reappeared with half a coconut shell full of a sharp-smelling milky juice. Mabbutt took it, bowed, and sipped gratefully. Whatever it wasn't milk. After another more cautious draught, he handed it back. The man smiled broadly and insisted he drink again, after which he could remember very little.
"Are you all right in there, Mr. Mabbutt?"
Mabbutt pulled himself up with an involuntary groan. He was lying stretched out on his bed, and darkness had fallen. Hamish Melville's head appeared through the tent flap. His eyes sparkled, and his face was creased into a smile. He held out a water bottle.
"You might need this."
He watched as Mabbutt drank deeply.
"How's the accommodation?"
"It's comfortable. Thank you very much."
"These came from a disbanded Boy Scout group in Peshawar. Headmaster of the school thought them a little too Baden Powell, you know. Not quite in keeping with the times."
Mabbutt finished the water.
"Anyway, when you're ready, come and join us."
Mabbutt felt distinctly groggy. The water had helped, but his mouth still tasted foul, and he realized he'd not cleaned his teeth for at least 24 hours. He found his toilet bag and toothbrush, and did the best job he could. When he stepped outside, he found that the campsite had been transformed. Lamps had been lit, and beneath the tree where he'd relieved himself, a generator thrummed. A trestle table had been set up, to one side of which was a fire over which a blackened pot was being stirred. Melville was at the table, staring into a laptop. Three Indians, all young and neatly dressed in tight cotton shirts or t-shirts, sat around him. One was on a mobile, the other two were studying a map. Hearing Mabbutt clear his throat, they looked up. Melville turned and called him forward with a wide introductory sweep of his arm.
"Gentlemen, meet Keith Prynne Mabbutt, citizen of the UK, born 29th of March 1953, the year of the coronation," he noted with mock gravitas. "Passport number 276394702. Occupation? Well, I'm sure we'll find that out in due course."
He indicated the one unoccupied chair at the table.
"Mr. Mabbutt, welcome to the University of Life. This is Kumar, this is Mahesh, Kinesh next to him, and I'm Monsieur Steiner, from Antwerp."
There was appreciative laughter around the table.
"Sit down and we'll get you a beer. Not Belgian, I'm afraid."
Mabbutt knew he was being teased, but guessed that this was all part of the process, a bluff but necessary way of flushing him out. After all the game-playing of the last few days, it was almost a relief. But he was aware that now, more than ever, he needed to keep his wits about him. One of the young men poured a beer and put the glass in front of him. Melville tapped at his keyboard with an air of finality, closed his laptop, and took in Mabbutt's beer appreciatively.
"I'll have one of those too, Kumar, if you don't mind, as we have a guest."
Food was laid on the table, in a cluster of small stainless steel bowls. Deep-fried aubergine, spinach, spiced okra, beans, lentils, pickles, yogurt, and tamarind juice.
Good for a hangover,
Melville assured him. Rice was ladled onto individual plates. Mabbott was discreetly handed a spoon, but the others, including Melville, tucked in with their fingers, moulding the rice into a ball which was then dipped in the various dishes before being popped into the mouth with a neat flick of the thumb. Melville's long and elegant hands were well suited to this dipping and rolling, and he seemed as deft at the technique as any of his Indian companions. Mabbott decided it was time to express his gratitude to Melville for rescuing him. The big man shrugged.
There are a lot of people around here who don't like white folks, period. And why should they? They see them arrive in their big cars with their World Bank briefcases, and they know that they're not here for a walk in the woods. They're off to the refinery. The refinery that was built on 23 local villages and surrounded by a 10-mile barbed wire fence. The refinery that makes people's eyes burn and their skin itch and their water taste bad.
He threw out an arm in the general direction of the village.
Give or take the odd ritual sacrifice, the Kidonga are basically friendly people, Keith. They look after each other and they look after the place where they live. They don't want much more than to be left alone. But as they live on some of the most mineral-rich land in India, that's getting to be a little more difficult. But they know I'm on their side. They trust me. That's why they gave you afternoon tea.
He broke into a wheezy laugh.
And a cocktail, I hear.
At this, the laughter echoed round the table.
A sago palm special on your first day here. Now that is an honour, Keith.
Melville's wide shoulders shook, and eventually Mabbott joined in.
Then there are those who pretend to be on their side, Melville continued, while basically using them to fight their own war. Eh, Kumar?
The stockiest of the three Indians angled his head in agreement, puffing his cheeks out as he did so.
You mean the Maoists? Asked Mabbott.
Melville chewed and swallowed. Then he stood, picked up a cup, and walked to a plastic bucket, from which he drew water. He splashed it on his hands, then nodded at Mabbott.
Naxalites. Maoists. Naxals. Mostly well-educated, committed to the overthrow of the government, the state, and pretty much everything else they don't like. They attach themselves to the tribals, appropriate their suffering, and turn it into anger. Then they turn the anger into control. And they do kill people. Mostly policemen, but they can be unpredictable. You just happen to wander into a village that's one of their recent acquisitions.
Farood was right then.
Farood?
My guide.
Some guide. He didn't want to come up here. He didn't have to.
This remark hung in the air, and Mabbott was aware that the mood around the table had changed imperceptibly. He took a sideways glance at Melville and found the craggy face turned towards him, the deep blue eyes appraising him as they had done when they first met in the street in Bhubaneswar.
Most lone travellers can't afford to hire a Toyota, Mr. Mabbott.
For a few moments, only the sound of the generator broke the silence. Mabbott knew he mustn't be stared down.
Well, thank you for saving our lives, he said quietly.
Melville's eyes flicked across the table.
Thanks to Kumar, I know most of those Maoist boys.
He pushed his plate to one side. As if at a signal, one of those who'd driven Mabbott back the previous night materialized from the darkness and began to clear the table.
They're not all bad, Melville added. We may disagree on motivation, but we agree on fundamentals.
There was a pause. Once again, Mabbott felt that he was being given space to explain himself, but the moment passed. There was general movement as people got up from the table, and Melville accepted a cigarette from one of the men. He squatted down and lit it using a stick at the edge of the fire, straightened up, and took a deep pull. He coughed lightly, but involuntarily.
Pavan, sorry, Mr. Singh, told me you were interested in the Astromex refinery.
Mabbott flinched. What else had he told him?
He thought that I might be more interested in that than another day of temples. The temples here are world class. I agree, but there may be a little too many of them.
Melville pushed back his hair and flicked his cigarette ash to one side.
Pavel is quite political, you know. He has an agenda. I'm sorry if he forced it on you.
Well, he was only trying to help.
He must have thought you'd be interested.
Yes.
Because most tourists aren't interested.
Melville returned to the table, pulled a lamp up close to him, and bent over the map. With his long hair, round glasses, and his long beak of a nose, he looked like some ancient alchemist.
Maybe he thought you were a kindred spirit.
Mabbott looked back into the darkness beyond the camp. Singh and Melville were formidable. They both had the same incisive way of cutting through bullshit, manoeuvring him towards the truth. There was no way back. From now on, it would have to be damage limitation.
I was once an environmental journalist. We sort of hit it off. A journalist? A long time ago. I wrote for local papers mainly, some nationals, occasionally. I did a series of stories on pollution, chemical spills from old-fashioned plants, that sort of thing. And?
And I stopped doing it. I didn't make myself very popular. Melville nodded.
I can imagine. And my wife was more interested in a secure income than environmental glory.
Melville leant back and began to roll himself another cigarette.
Family? Two children. Well, not children, young adults, I think they call them. A happy family. I envy you.
That's what I thought, but my wife thought otherwise. She's not living with me anymore. Melville raised an eyebrow.
So what are you doing now?
Mabbott came very close to an admission, but some instinct told him to hold back.
Well, I've just finished a vanity project for an oil company, nothing I was proud of. So, yes, I thought I'd look around the world for a bit.
Melville drew his head back in mock disapproval.
A vanity project for an oil company? What sort of thing's that?
Mabbott smiled cautiously. This was a delicate game. A history of the Sullivo oil terminal. Much to Mabbott's relief, Melville greeted this with a rich chuckle.
No threat to Harry Potter, then?
I don't know about that. It's another tale of Scottish wizardry. Melville nodded in agreement. He took a pull on his cigarette, and as he exhaled, he frowned, as if recalling something.
From what I know, the Shetlanders did pretty well out of Sullivo.
That's true.
There are plenty of people here who think that aluminium will be the saving of this place.
Melville went on.
It's a poor area, after all.
He looked across the table. Again, Mabbott had that disconcerting feeling of being mentally frisked. But he had told enough of the truth to be able to return Melville's steady gaze.
So what do you think?
Mabbott shrugged.
I've no idea. I'm just looking and learning.
This seemed to amuse Melville.
And who's going to look after you now that your guide's gone home?
Funnily enough, this was something Mabbott hadn't really thought about.
Well, I shall look after myself. There must be a tourist office in town.
There was a grunt of laughter from Melville.
This isn't Paris.
No, I suppose not. Melville folded up the map, took off his glasses, and rubbed his eyes. Then, as if he had taken a decision, he briskly stood up.
We can get you back to Bhubaneswar, but we've a little business to do on the way.
Mabbott realized there was only one possible answer.
That's great. Thanks. We start early, but then everyone does around here.
I'll be ready, and well, it was time to take the first step towards full disclosure.
Yes?
I just wanted to say what anyone who's ever cared about the environment would say. It's an honor to meet you. Melville's expression hardly flickered, a hint of a smile. Then he reached across the table for a pile of papers.
You'll find some water in your tent.
Mabbott nodded.
Thank you.
And good night. He was on his way to his tent, when Melville called out to him.
Mr. Mabbott, there is one important rule. What happens here stays here. I'm sure you understand.
Of course. He held Melville's eye for a beat longer than was comfortable.
Sleep well.
Chapter 6. The call came before dawn. Mabbat drank in the sweet, cool smell of the morning and downed his cup of black tea. Village life was already in full swing. Smoke rose from fires, cockerels were crowing, chickens clucking, and dogs barking. Figures could be seen beyond the village limits, squatting out in the countryside, adding their contribution to the night soil. With a tinkling of bells, a line of goats was being led out of the compound by two small children. Breakfast was modest, and by the time the first light had risen on the eastern horizon, the tents had been struck, and the two vehicles packed up and made ready. Melville was businesslike. The banter had gone, and he communicated through a series of barked orders. Once he was satisfied, he waved Mabbat towards a jeep. It was the one in which he'd been rescued two nights earlier.
"You ride up front with Kinesh."
Melville, dressed in a cotton shirt and a billowing shalwar, slung his backpack into the vehicle in front and jumped aboard. Kumar revved his engine, hooted the horn, and the two 4x4s turned away from the camp, circled the village, and bounced away to the west. Kinesh was the youngest of the three who'd been at the table last night. He sat tall and very upright, as if he might have been in the army at some point. He kept his eyes firmly on the road ahead. The jeep tipped forward as it followed Kumar's into a red earth ravine. Mabbat clung onto the handle above the window as they accelerated up the bank on the far side. He was painfully aware that his presence among the group was not likely to last long. Last night, he was a new arrival, an amusing diversion at the end of a busy day. This morning, he was a burden. He could sense this coming off Kinesh as the car swung along the track and the young man stared silently ahead. Mabbat knew that there was a distinct possibility that his pursuit of Melville could be over in the next few hours. He had to start work with whatever material he had. Mabbat looked across at his driver. He was light-skinned with a strong angular profile and a large jutting nose.
"Have you worked for Mr. Melville long?"
asked Mabbat. Kinesh nodded. He was adjusting the mirror.
"When he comes here."
"Which is how often?"
2, maybe 3 times a year, sir."
Kinesh threw the vehicle into four-wheel drive as they dived down into an old river channel, empty of water but thick with freshly dried mud.
"It must be a privilege to work with him."
"Yes, sir."
The sirs rang with contempt. Mabbat waited a while before he spoke again, partly to see whether Kinesh might volunteer something, partly because he didn't want it to sound like an interrogation. At that moment, two vividly coloured birds flew out of the bushes ahead of them and disappeared into the trees in a flash of scarlet and grey. Mabbat grunted with surprise.
"Red-whiskered bulbul, Pycnonotus jocosus,"
said Kinesh matter-of-factly.
"Thank you."
"Mountain birds."
"Are we high up?"
800 meters.
The plane had levelled out by now, and Kinesh hung back as the dust cloud from Kumar's car billowed out ahead of them.
"Were you born here?"
Kinesh shook his head.
"Only Kumar is from here, sir."
"And you?"
"I am from Delhi."
"So how come you hooked up with Mr. Melville?"
"I was at university. I'm studying biology and environmental science, and he came to talk to us about the damage we are doing to our environment here in India."
Mabbat looked around him. The trees were more abundant here than at the camp, and there were bright yellow bushes and smooth grey boulders rising behind them.
"Looks pretty good to me."
Kinesh smiled grimly.
"Wait and see, sir."
The sun was high and hot by the time they reached a metalled road. After the jolting of the past hour, Mabbat breathed an audible sigh of relief. Kinesh pointed to an incongruous line of grey electricity pylons, hoisting swags of cable across the road and into the bush.
"On their way to Kalpra, sir."
"Kalpra?"
Kinesh sounded almost scornful.
"The biggest aluminium refinery in the state."
"But more electricity's a good thing for everyone, isn't it?"
"If everyone had it, yes, sir. 70% of this supply is for the private mining companies. 1 ton of alumina needs 250 megawatts of electricity. Kalpra will produce 6 million tons of aluminium, so they need 1,500 million megawatts a year, which is 60 million tons of CO2. And they want more plants, so that means moving more people off the land they have lived on for 2,000 years.
Kinesh blared his horn as a packed bus hurtled past, pushing them close to the serrated rim of the road.
And now they want the secret hills, too, in order to make them even more rich.
There was something about Ganesh's delivery that raised Mabbott's critical hackles. He'd heard the same thing said at Solemvo. If anyone gets rich, it's bad for everyone else. He had sympathy for the view, but basically it was dishonest.
We all use aluminium. Your car, your mobile phone, your cooking pots and aeroplanes. And we pay a lot of money to the company, sir. They make big profits from us. But the people who live in the way of Kaupra pay with their livelihood. 5,000 hectares of farmland cleared for the refinery.
But you are an educated man, Kinesh. Do you not think people have to change, learn new things, to be given the chance to be as educated as you are?
Sir, my father once told me, you carry too much in your head. You should learn to carry more on your head. That was what my father told me, sir, to respect the old ways.
For the first time, his passion sounded personal. And for the first time, the merest flicker of a smile crossed this serious young man's face. The road flattened out, and Mabbott felt his eyes closing as the steady hum of the engine and the monotony of the landscape lulled him to sleep. He woke, suddenly, thrown forward by an abrupt halt and the sound of a deep-throated horn. A truck was hurtling straight towards them, veering away from head-on collision by a matter of inches.
"Bulk carriers from Kaupra up and down this road all the time!"
Kinesh reached for a cloth and wiped his hands, before slowly moving off again. Mabbott could now see what the problem was. Half the road was being relaid, and traffic had been diverted into one lane. Kinesh gestured ahead.
"They want a bigger road to take all the trucks. That's what is happening here."
Mabbott looked out curiously as they passed the roadworks. It seemed as if all the work was being done by women. Some wielded pickaxes and were opening up holes in the road, while others filled their baskets with granite chippings and carried them on their heads to the holes. The women were of all ages, from young girls to grandmothers, and all wore dusty saris which drifted in the breeze. None had protective clothing of any kind.
"They're women. The road builders are all women."
"You'll see them all over India, sir."
Kinesh nodded grimly as they bumped over the freshly laid road.
"They're Dalits.
Bottom of the caste system."
"They're outside the caste system, sir. They are untouchables."
"But they must have rights, to be dressed properly at least."
"They have no rights, sir,"
Kinesh replied quietly. Two women stepped back to let them pass. Both were tall and fine-featured, but the work had left them gaunt and lifeless. Their eyes met Mabbott's as the car drove past, but there was no change in their expression. For a long time, Mabbott stared into the wing mirror, unable to take his eyes off them as they slowly went back to work, like phantoms. A few miles farther on, Melville's car signalled a left turn, and they followed a road which led up through the forest for an hour or more, before pulling to a halt on a rock-strewn track. Melville was first out of his vehicle, camera slung over his shoulder, directing the others with brisk hand movements. His wayward hair was tucked beneath a felt cap, and his white kurta billowed as he ran. Mabbott was impressed. Here was a 75-year-old ex-banker, looking for all the world like a mujahid taking on the Russians. Putting his finger to his lips, Melville beckoned Kinesh to kill his engine. He came across to the car, and they spoke briefly in Hindi. A small yellow bird skittered across the glade, and Mabbott noticed Kinesh's sudden upward glance. Kumar and Mahesh didn't seem interested. They stood by their jeep, loading backpacks. Melville came across and whispered into Mabbott's window.
"We're stopping for a while to take some photographs. Bit of field work, you know."
"Can I come with you?"
"No."
Melville nodded at Kinesh.
"If you want to help, you can stay with Kinesh and keep an eye on the vehicles."
With that, he motioned to Kumar and Mahesh, and the three of them moved quickly away, over a fallen tree, down a narrow watercourse, and out of sight. A radio crackled, and Kinesh leant into the cab. There was a brief discussion, then the receiver was clicked off.
"Water, sir?"
"After you."
"There's one for each of us."
The water was cool, and Mabbott drank greedily. A sudden, very loud crash came from the trees above him, and he jumped, spilling the water as he did so. Kinesh reached into the glove compartment and took out a pair of binoculars.
"What was that?"
Mabbott asked.
"Malabar pied hornbill, Anthracoceros coronatus," Kinesh replied, scanning the trees. "Yellow beak, blue, black and white tail. Powdered hornbill beak is very much sought after. It is good for vigour."
He followed the bird with the binoculars as it flapped off noisily into the forest, then turned back to Mabbott.
"You like birds, sir?"
he asked as they wandered a short distance along the track.
"My father did. He was brought up in the country."
"And you are not, sir?"
"No, I'm a city boy. Leeds, Yorkshire. I live in London now."
"I should like to see London,"
Kinesh said with feeling. He glanced up into the trees again, as if searching for something.
"I hate it here."
"You hate it? Why do you hate it?"
"I don't like what India is becoming, sir. This country of the very rich and the very poor. And because so many are very poor, the rich can get richer even quicker. And they don't care, you know. They don't even live in this country, most of them."
"It's progress, Kinesh."
"That's what I used to think, but Mr. Melville has changed my mind. He says we have to be true to each other. We have to recognize that we are all similar. No one is inferior." "That's what he says, sir. And believe me..."
"Shh!" Kinesh turned at the same time as Mabbott. They watched as a black SUV approached along the road below them and drew to a halt. Two men got out. They were wearing dark glasses, identical white shirts and chinos. Kinesh's eyes widened.
"Security," he whispered.
One of the men was staring up at their cars. The other had lit a cigarette. He took a leisurely drag, then the two of them began to advance up the track.
"I must warn the others," said Kinesh. "You stay here. Keep them talking."
"About what?"
"Anything."
Kinesh bent double, snaked his way back to the vehicles. Mabbott walked towards the men, trying to look assured, innocent even. He was aware that his heart was beating fast, and his legs felt oddly unsteady. He gave them a broad smile.
"Beautiful spot."
The two men stopped.
"Where are you from?"
"England."
"UK?"
"If you'd rather."
"Why do you stop here?"
I'm bird-watching."
The taller of the two men took off his imitation Ray-Bans and appraised Mabbott. "The birds round here are fantastic, don't you think?" He could hear the crackle of the radio from their car. Mabbott knew he had to press home the advantage.
"I've come all the way from London to see them."
"See what?"
"The Malabar pied hornbill. Anthracoceros corona. The red-whiskered bulbul. Picolotus jocotus. And so many others."
"There's one now,"
Mabbott shouted, and pointed into the forest behind them. As they wheeled round, he stole a quick look back at the vehicles. Kinesh couldn't be seen. Mabbott smiled what he hoped was a suitably deranged and obsessive smile as the men turned back to him.
"Did you catch that? Tiny bird, blue upper parts, tan breast. Native of Nepal, lovely."
His act certainly worked on one of them, who shook his head, muttered to his companion, and began to back away. But the other man lingered, looking behind Mabbott towards the two vehicles.
"Why two?"
"Why two what?"
"Why you have two vehicles?"
"There are a group of us."
"Where are the others?"
"In the forest, spotting."
Then Mabbott made his first mistake. As the younger man moved up the slope towards him, Mabbott instinctively went to block his path. It was a clumsy move, and the man, now close enough to Mabbott to see the sweat on his face, tensed up and shouted to his colleague. He, in turn, headed back up the hill.
"This is a high-security area," said the first one. "We should like to examine your cars."
"Are you police?"
"It would be in your interest to let us see them."
They pushed past him, and Mabbott turned, stricken. There was nothing more he could do. Then quite suddenly, from deep within the forest, came a growing, surging roar. The tree canopy sprang into life, and the air was split by shrieks and screams and the beating of wings. The massive roar came again, much nearer now, and the squawks intensified. Trees and branches began to sway, and all heads turned towards the road. There, where once had been a dense and leafy vista of sal and tamarind, stood a wall of steel. Mabbott recognized it instantly. It was the convoy. The huge haulage unit at the front, its cab as high as the young trees around it, steamed and hissed with anger as it towered over the white Subaru that stood in its path. A third and prolonged blast of the horn sounded. The two security men raced down to the road as the sound filled the forest, amplified by others behind it in a syncopated bellow of rage. Mabbott watched open-mouthed as the SUV skidded round and, like a mouse before an elephant, shot off down the road. With a squeal of releasing air brakes, the truck lumbered into motion, drawing its massive load behind it. Then the next in line began to haul itself up the hill, boughs snapping in its wake. The third transporter, which had been halted on a steeper slope, took longer to get going. The cab reared and bounced like a horse at a jump, and it seemed an age before the gears engaged and the last of the immense loads thundered by, leaving behind it something equally unnatural, a forest devoid of any sound at all. Mabbott remained standing there for some time, shaken, almost literally, by what he had seen. He turned only when he heard voices behind him. Kumar and Mahesh were zigzagging back through the trees, with Melville a little farther behind. Kinesh was already at the cars, stowing equipment, fitting cameras back into boxes. Melville grinned at Mabbott as he emerged into the glade.
"Good work, guys,"
he called out to Kinesh.
"Map!"
He looked at the map briefly, then, calling out coordinates to Kumar, jumped into the first jeep.
"Let's get out of here."
It was a difficult half hour as the vehicles skirted the main road and weaved along forest tracks. Kinesh said little as he concentrated on squeezing the jeep between trees, crossing streams and negotiating tricky gradients, and it wasn't until they reached the outskirts of a sprawling village that Mabbott realized how much his companion's attitude had changed in the course of a morning. Elation had tempered caution, and youthful exuberance had softened his seriousness. As they sat round a table in the anonymous main street, he realized that this mood had filtered down from the top. Melville's eyes shone as he spoke.
"That was something. I tell you, if you wanted proof that they're stepping up capacity, we have it now. Those new smelters are so important, they'll be moving the parts in 24 hours a day. That's why their goons are driving around the forest like they own the place."
He looked at Mabbott, and his smile finally seemed devoid of suspicion.
"I'm sorry you had to meet them face to face. If they'd looked inside our vehicles, we'd have been in real trouble, so thanks for helping out."
Bindi bhajis arrived at the table, freshly fried from the pan.
"Why are they all so jumpy?"
asked Mabbott as he ate.
"The Kalpur refinery was built 5 years ago after a whole series of dodgy planning permissions. A lot of money went into a lot of pockets. Astromex got what they wanted, and the state lost 600 hectares of good farmland."
Melville seemed to be in his element. There was none of the caution he displayed back at the camp. This was Melville unplugged, and all Mabbott had to do now was listen and try to remember what he said.
"These guys can never get enough. Once they've sniffed the ground, then it's only the dollar signs that matter. Astromex want to double the amount of aluminium coming out of Kalpra, and what we found proof of this morning is that they're not bothering to wait for permission. The new equipment's being shipped in fast, a fait accompli. That's the way these people operate. Do what you want, and don't let the other side stop you."
Melville paused, took some more food, and passed the plate around.
"The trouble is that the Kalpur refinery is limited at the moment by having to bring the basic raw material, the bauxite, in from outside. If they can find it somewhere closer, then things will be a lot easier for them and a lot more profitable. And, surprise, surprise, they have found bauxite deposits a lot nearer. In the hills, right next to the plant. What could be better than that? Except that there are people living in those hills, thousands of them, and they've been living there for as long as anyone knows. They worship the Masoka Hills as the reason for their survival, and not without good reason. Bauxite holds and distributes water, so two or three rivers and a whole network of streams rise on those hills. Strip the crown, and the rain will just run away down the flanks. That would mean the end of a way of life and an irrigation system that provides cultivable land right down to the sea."
He gestured to Kumar, who reached into his bag and produced a bottle of water, loosening the cap as he passed it over. Melville drank deeply, and passed it across to Mabbott.
Thanks to this morning's nature ramble, we now have incontrovertible evidence that Astromex is bringing in heavy plant that can only be justified by the extraction of bauxite from the local hills.
So, what can you do about it? Melville exchanged glances with the three others. He looked at Mabbott carefully, but not unkindly.
We shall see.
Chapter 7. Mabbott was happy, not just with the events of the day, but also because there had been no more mention of putting him on a train back to Bhubaneswar, at least not yet. For a second night, he found himself in Melville's camp. It was set up at the base of a smoothly eroded granite outcrop, whose quartz crystals sparkled in the glow of the setting sun. Kumar and the boys busied themselves with a generator, which coughed and spluttered into life. In his tent, Mabbott took out his phone and found two text messages from Ron Latham, which he ignored, and one from Christina, leaving only her name. There was just enough battery left for a single call. He checked the coast was clear, then tapped in her number. There was a long pause. He was about to hang up when the connection clicked in.
"It's me."
She seemed to be expecting him.
"Where are you?"
"I'm in India."
"Are you safe?" "Yes, of course I am. Why shouldn't I be?" "Your agent rang me. Then a man who spoke like a recorded message."
"Ron Latham. He rang you."
"He kept asking if you'd called. Why is he chasing you?"
"He's paying me, that's why." He could almost hear the sound of her ears pricking up.
"Should I tell him you called?"
No, Chris. Don't have anything to do with him. He'll never leave you alone."
"Is he going to make you rich?"
"Would that make a difference?"
"It would make a difference to you."
It wasn't the answer he'd hoped for.
"Where's Rex?"
But the phone went dead. No more charge.
"Fuck. Everything all right?"
A shaggy grey head peered round the flap. It was Melville.
"We're eating soon."
"Oh, thanks. I'll join you." Melville pointed at the phone.
"You want that thing charged?"
"Sometimes I think I prefer it this way," said Mabbott, trying to make light of the situation.
"Couldn't agree more. Only use mine for working."
Mabbott handed the phone to Melville.
"When you're ready, then. Kumar's cooking, not to be missed."
Outside, a fire had been lit, and Mahesh and Kinesh were hunkered down around the portable table. Cobra beers were opened, and laptops and mobiles set up. All three men were engrossed in their work, which consisted mainly of long phone conversations, almost entirely in Hindi. Occasionally, Kumar would be called away from the fire, and another language was spoken. Feeling rather like a spare part in the midst of all this activity, Mabbott wandered to the edge of the camp. The sun dipped below the horizon, and night came almost instantly. He walked a little farther, outside the ring of light around the camp, and sniffed the air. It was very dry here, and the smells he picked up were reminiscent of fire, of burnt things. A breeze blew up, and he could hear the creaking of a tree branch. He squatted down, ferreting around in the dust, until he found a stone whose weight and smoothness pleased him. Turning it over in his hand, he tried to concentrate his mind on what had once been his life. Christina, sitting with him at the kitchen table, shaking her head at his outrage over something he'd read in the newspaper. Or Sam, before the theatre had seduced him, chasing a ball on a Suffolk beach. And Jay, before the complications of Shiraj, lying on her tummy in front of the fire, twisting a lock of hair as she devoured a book.
"Heath!"
It was Melville's voice.
"Grab up!"
Mabbott checked his watch. Almost half an hour had gone by, and he was still holding the stone he had picked up. He stood and hurled it as far as he could into the bush, then turned back to the camp. They ate simple but tasty food, tandoori chicken with lentils and potatoes, and a small but spicy curry. A lamp in the centre of the table flickered in what was now a deliciously cooling breeze. They reminisced about the day, and there were many jokes about Mabbott's sudden conversion to birdwatching. Melville lit a cigarette and took another beer, and embarked on a long and elaborate account of the mating habits of the hornbill, Kumar picked up one of the clay pots in which the food had been prepared and described in detail how a nearby tribe had devised a similar pot for the collection of sago palm juice. The young boys would carry these pots to the top of the trees and hang them there to collect the sticky white sap, which was converted into the indispensable village brew. This led to a spirited argument about how much could be collected from each tree. Mahesh had heard that it was a litre a night. Kumar swore that a good tree would give as much as 5 litres a night, and another 5 during the day. This led on to a discussion of how best to climb trees, and, almost inevitably, to a late-night race up a nearby mahua tree, won, impressively, by Kumar. A triumph of technique over physique. Sometimes Melville joined in, and sometimes he sat back and regarded his protégés like an indulgent father. Far from playing the role of guru, he seemed happiest indulging in jest and banter. At one point, Kumar chided the great man over his inability to master Toi, the dialect of the Masira peoples. Melville protested, and after a few misplaced attempts, he brought Kumar to his knees with laughter, then saved the day by faultlessly reciting the local names of all the village chiefs. It was one of those rare evenings that could never be planned. When everyone present, Kinesh, the thoughtful idealist from Delhi, Mahesh, the high-tech wizard with 3 children in Kolkata, Kumar, the educated tribal, Melville, the living legend, and Mabbott, his secret biographer, ceased for a few hours to be anything other than fellow human beings. This was certainly Mabbott's view, as he walked some distance away and stood, a little unsteadily, relieving himself beneath the tree up which Kumar had so recently scampered. When he turned back to the camp, the boys had gone to their tents, and only Melville was left, sitting at the flimsy table, map open in the lamplight, his profile throwing shadows over a nearby tent. He looked up as Mabbott approached, and laid something on the table.
"Your phone. All charged up."
"Thanks. And thanks for including me. That was a good night." He went to take the phone, but as he did so, Melville withdrew it. There was a moment's pause. Something had changed. Melville was examining him with that uncomfortable, inquisitorial stare again. Mabbott was aware that the beers had loosened his tongue. Maybe he'd said too much.
"We'll be moving early tomorrow. Kumar'll call you at 4.
Mabbott gave a grimace.
"Fine. Early bird. We'll drop you at Kindara Junction by 6. There's a train to Bhubaneswar at 7:30. Sleep well."
Melville returned to his map, one hand still resting on the phone. Mabbott stood there feeling foolish. He had deluded himself that what had happened that day was confirmation that he was now a part of it all, whatever it was. Now he was quietly and firmly being reminded of reality, that as far as Melville was concerned, he was in the way and would remain so. But something, some sprig of indignation, stirred inside him. Mabbott reminded himself that he was 56 years old and had at one time been a journalist whom many had envied. He had come so close to his story, and he was not going to lose it without a fight.
"I'd like to stay with you, if that's possible." "I'm sure you would."
Melville didn't look up.
"I can pay my way. Put some money in the kitty."
Melville dropped his pencil, and it slowly rolled across the map, stopping, as if he'd always intended it to, just before the edge of the table. He looked up. His eyes were flat and hard.
"I can't do that, Keith."
Mabbott felt a chill and at the same time a realization that, for better or worse, cards must be put on the table.
"I can't do that," Melville repeated. "Not without knowing a little more about you."
Mabbott shrugged.
"There isn't much to know. I'm just..."
Melville held up the phone.
"Like why you're working for Urgent Books."
Which is how it happened. Instead of telling Melville why he was here, Melville told him why he was here. Ron Latham's name and number were all over his mobile, a string of Latham's messages awaiting replies. And Melville's tentacles seemed to stretch far and wide. By the time the short, sharp grilling was over, it was clear that Melville had most of the information about him. He knew about the car hire. He knew about the hotel bookings. There was nothing left to deny.
So, why are you here?
To write a book about you.
Melville betrayed just the trace of a smile.
Now we're talking. You mean they want a book about me, and they're paying you to do it.
Is that such a bad thing?
Melville leant back.
I can save you a lot of time and effort right now. I'm not interested in talking about myself. I'm interested in what I can do in the time left to me to prevent a little of the damage we seem hell-bent on inflicting on this long-suffering planet. I'm not the story.
He gestured towards the horizon.
These people are the story. The Masira Kidonga, the Musa, the Giara. The way things are going, they have even less time than I do. And that's just here in India. There are people all over the world who are being rolled over. I don't have time, Keith, for newspaper puffs and glossy profiles. That's another world. The world that wants us all to keep buying and consuming and stuffing ourselves, whatever the cost to those around us.
Mabbott felt invigorated by finally being able to talk openly, and he felt a vehemence too.
With respect, Mr. Melville, you could just have handed me the opening paragraph. That's why, like it or not, you are admired by every generation. You've earned it by following your own path, by not taking anyone else's shilling, and that gives you the immense privilege of being listened to. Your story is the story of all the causes you've championed. Through your story, their story is told. It's what you've dedicated your life to, giving a voice to the anonymous and powerless. I just want to help that voice be heard.
Melville's pole-like frame had bent lower and lower over the table. His long, thin hands had come up over his face, and it was clear he was shaking. Mabbott wondered just for a moment if he might have moved the man. But when Melville finally straightened up, it was somewhat humiliating to see that the tears were tears of laughter.
Oh, dear.
Melville took a deep breath and gestured at the table.
Sit yourself down before you have a heart attack.
Mabbott, by now deeply confused, pulled out a chair.
I'm sorry, I didn't mean to mock, but I had you down for an old hack.
Melville held up his hand to forestall any protest.
A decent old hack, but suddenly...
He shook his head, still gurgling with laughter.
You're Martin Luther King, for fuck's sake!
There was a sudden gust of wind and a hiss as dust scattered. Melville wiped his eyes and spread his hands apologetically.
I'm sorry, we've all been working too hard.
He reached for a tin and picked out a hand-rolled cigarette.
So, Keith, before I kick you out for spying, I feel I at least owe you an explanation. Smoke?
Mabbott shook his head.
Bad habit.
A flame sprang from the match.
One of many.
Melville drew on the cigarette and looked up at the night sky.
What you have to realize is that I'm not a god figure. I'm not even a good figure. I'm someone who wasn't great at school, who flunked university, who chased women until he found the wrong one, and then married her. I traveled to get away from the mess I'd left at home, found that I could get on better with people abroad than I could get on with people at home, and that's pretty much all there is to it. I'm not an admirable man, Keith. I like these people. I stay out here because I like them much more than the idiots I have to deal with back home. If the media has me down as some kind of recluse, that's because I have 3 million better things to do than accept awards and give press conferences. I work at my own pace, in my own way, with people I respect. If that's being a wild card or a man of mystery, so be it. You people love labels. You love to have everyone pinned down like butterflies on a board. It is one of the great illusions that a free press makes us all free spirits. What they really want is for us all to come out alike, quantifiable, accessible, programmable, die-stamped off the same production line.
He took one more drag on his cigarette, then flicked the stub past Mabbott into the darkness.
So forgive me, Keith, if I'm not quite ready for the file marked Hamish Melville, living legend.
He half rose, as if to bring the evening to a conclusion, but Mabbott held up his hand. Melville had set out his case. Now it was his turn, and perhaps his last chance.
Look, I apologize for being devious and secretive, but the really important thing is that I took on this book because I believe in the same things as you do. I always have. I fought big companies because I knew they were lying, and that, in some cases, people were dying because of those lies. I like to think that in a very tiny and marginal way, I was fighting the same battles as you. The difference between us is that I'm that lowest form of human life, a journalist. But we need the public eye to help us fight our battles. Being heard by as large an audience as possible is what we have to do. You have been very successful at what you do, getting projects cancelled, saving lives and livelihoods. But you never have to explain yourself to anyone. Melville made to speak. With respect, Mr. Melville, I know what you're going to say. So what? Why should I? That you couldn't do what you do without privacy. But what you can't expect is that people such as myself and others who see you as a role model for getting good things done in a shitty old world should be incurious about how you do it. You may think of me as a spy, but all I can say is that I'm spying for the best possible reason, which is that I think the world is a better place because of you, and I want more people to follow your example.
Melville stood. He sniffed the air and looked up into the sky.
"Weather's due for a change," he said,
not altogether happily. Then he checked his watch.
"We've an early start."
Mabbott nodded and reached for his phone. But Melville kept his hand on it.